You're listening to Sunday Extra here on RN. Jonathan Green with you. Hope you're having a lovely Easter Sunday morning. Coming up for you in this hour, we revisit two interviews, first broadcast in February this year, each giving a rather different opinion on the importance of commemorating Australia's involvement in the First World War. Now, my first guest, historian Henry Reynolds, refers to it as the ongoing carnival of military commemoration. He also says that more attention should be paid to the frontier wars that he describes between Aboriginals and white settlers. The director of the Australian War Memorial, Brendan Nelson, is next. And on the other hand, he says the First World War remains the nation's defining period. An extraordinary moment for Australia post-European settlement. We begin with Reynolds, whose book The Forgotten Wars was awarded the Victorian Premier's Literary Prize for non-fiction this year. Henry begins by explaining how we've come a long way in terms of acknowledging the frontier wars, but still don't know quite what to do about it.
It raises that very big question that if indeed, as I argue, that this was war and an important war, then how do we deal with it in relation to this overall national sense that war was the defining national experience? A thing that we are going to spend more and more money and more time commemorating and celebrating, and also remembering with sadness and regret. And so all of these things, it seems to me, are coming together in a situation where we've really got to decide what we're going to do about the war in Australia.
We have a moment, don't we? I mean, 2014, so that's the centenary of the beginning of the First World War. Next year will, of course, be the centenary of Gallipoli, and this is that paradox again. This is the war which we choose, that invasion, as you put it, the invasion of Turkey, the moment that we choose as the defining national experience. If we were to acknowledge those frontier wars of the 19th century, that would change everything about that discussion around recognition, around reconciliation.
Yes, I think so. I have real problems with seeing Gallipoli as being the central national experience. In fact, having made the nation for all sorts of reasons, which I won't go into for the moment. But if you think about what was the war about and what was achieved by the conflict or by the particularly that campaign in Turkey, you've got to come to the conclusion that it was a campaign that achieved nothing for Australia in any practical sense, and it led to the loss of many, many lives, that people who, young men who died unnecessarily. But if you look at the conflict within Australia, now clearly it was a very different sort of conflict. It certainly had, many, many people died, both black and white, but overwhelmingly black. But it's not so much the way it was fought, the weapons that were used, the tactics, the number of people who died, but rather the question of what was this war about. Mm. Now, clearly this war was about both the ownership and the control of a whole continent. That is, the ownership of the land and the right to exploit the land and the sovereignty in the world of who actually was the sovereign power in the Australian continent. Now, these are very, very big themes. You can't get bigger ones. And it's for that reason that I would argue that with the exception of the Pacific War after 1941, this was our most important war. It was much more important than the First World War for us.
Yes, because it made us what we are. I mean, it's an interesting thing. If you look, for example, at the American comparison, they too had a frontier war. They too were trying to subdue an occupying people and take control of that country. But it's something in that culture far more recognised, and from that recognition there are still obvious issues of reconciliation and harmony between the peoples, but from that recognition they can move on to a much more confident sense of national self, which is perhaps a confidence we lack, given our lack of recognition.
Yes, I mean, the Americans had both the War of Independence and, of course, the overwhelming experience of the Civil War. But yet they do continue to see conflict with the Indians as warfare. If you look at the official American accounts of American wars, they list all the conflicts with the Indians, even small little wars that killed, you know, half a dozen people. They are still included as wars. The Indian wars are recognized within America as wars. Now, this is partly because they, from the very beginning, recognized that the Indians owned the land and that they had sovereignty over the land. And when the British came in and then the Republic, the view was that the Indians continued to have a form of sovereignty, which they still do. Mm. They were seen as domestic dependent nations. So in a sense, that meant that they realized they were in conflict with sovereign nations. And therefore, they recognized even the smallest conflict as war.
Forgotten Wars is the new book from historian Henry Reynolds, and he joined you this morning on Sunday Extra. It's more than just semantics, though, isn't it, Henry? It's although that is so important to define those conflicts as war, changes our sense of what took place around Australia through the 19th century.
Yes, it does. And above all, it pays the sort of respect to the Aboriginal people, the Aboriginal nations, who almost overwhelmingly at some time came into conflict with, usually with settlers rather than government, who came into conflict with the incoming Europeans. It means that we need to respect their fighting, their conflict, their resistance, their attempt to keep control over their territory. We should recognise this and pay it as much respect as we do to the wars we fought overseas. In fact, I would argue we should pay it more respect. That is, we should see them as patriots fighting for their country, and heroic patriots, because they were frequently fighting against impossible odds.
Which takes us back to some extent, to the attitudes that were expressed during the 19th century, I mean, when that situation was far more acknowledged.
It was. In fact, I begin the book with the most extraordinary letter that was written in 1830 to a paper in Launceston in Tasmania, where the writer posed questions for us that we still haven't satisfactorily dealt with. That is, were these people mere criminals, or were they patriots? And if they were patriots, we've got to treat them as if we capture them, they're prisoners of war. But above all, we should respect their heroic struggle to defend their country. Now, I can't quite see why we can't view it that way. It shouldn't be difficult this far away from the conflict to recognise the Aborigines as patriots fighting for Australia in a way that most Australian soldiers weren't fighting for Australia, at least not in Australia.
I wonder too, in that recognition, I mean, you would therefore, there would be a place in great national institutions like the Australian War Memorial, for example, for recognition of that conflict and for paying it its due. What's the response from organisations like that to ideas of that type?
Well, this has been proposed many times over the last 20 years by the Bill Dean, the High Court Judge and Governor General, by Geoffrey Blainey long ago, and by Ken Inglis and numerous other people. And the War Memorial, and indeed, as far as I understand it, there has been a debate within the War Memorial. I mean, Peter Stanley, who was at the War Memorial for many years, has explained that there was constant resistance to the idea of recognising conflict within Australia as warfare, and that it still appears to be the situation. I mean, Brendan Nelson, the new chairman of the board of the War Memorial, has said, well, it's not going to happen on my watch for the next 5 years. And indeed, apparently, in a recent interview, he simply said it wasn't war, and therefore the War Memorial can't pay any attention to it. If it is going to be dealt with, it is the job of the National Museum.
Yes, it wasn't war. I mean, this is the key point, and this is the thing which I guess fluctuates through our history. As you say, acknowledged in the 19th century, removed through the mid-course of the 20th century and restored somewhat latterly. I mean, people like myself who grew up in schools through the 60s and 70s, I mean, the essence of Australian settlement and occupation was its peaceableness, we were taught. There was an entirely almost amicable exchange of land between black and white.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, for a long time, probably from the late 19th century, well into the second half of the 20th century, we comforted ourselves by believing that indeed Australian settlement was uniquely peaceful. And that's partly because we'd removed the Aborigines from the history books. I mean, almost completely, right up to the 1960s. Now, if you remove the Aborigines, indeed, it is a pretty peaceful place. I mean, there's Eureka Stockade, there are bushrangers, there are a few people killed here and there, but above all, by world standards, it is a remarkably peaceful story, and it's a very nice, benign story. But if you bring the Aborigines back into the story, then it changes it completely. Now, the other thing that happened, of course, was that with the recognition by the High Court in the Mabo judgment of 1992 that the Aborigines had a form of property, they had a form of tenure, which the common law could recognise, it meant that it was impossible any longer to say the war was just about, Aborigines stealing or women fighting over women, that it was more like a wave of crime. Mm. You could no longer say that once the High Court had determined that from the beginning of settlement, the Aborigines were the landowners and the landholders in occupation of the continent. So clearly the war was about that problem, that they owned and occupied the land. Now, constitutional recognition, I presume, also implicitly suggests that they also had sovereignty. They were the sovereign powers. The nations, the small Aboriginal nations, had sovereign power. So we simply have to recognise the blindingly obvious that there was conflict, and as a result of that conflict, both the property and the sovereignty passed from the Indigenous people to the British, the imperial and then the colonial governments and the settlers. And that was one of the largest transfers of property and sovereignty in modern history.
And I think this is what Tony Abbott gets at too, with his sense of the importance of that recognition. I mean, he has suggested in the past, as have others, that there is this hollowness in the sense of the country, from both black and white, this hollowness of the sort of gulf of understanding of the which needs to be filled with a more truthful account of our history, that then would allow us to go forward on a much more firm and reconciled footing.
I think that's right. I had quite a lot to do with the reconciliation movement of the 1990s. Initially, I was sceptical, but I got very involved in many parts of the country, and I thought it was an important movement, particularly locally in many parts of Australia. But it seemed to me that ultimately it was wanting Aboriginal people to become reconciled with what had happened to them. It wasn't whites reconciling with what they had done. And so therefore it left open this question of what do we do about this central theme in our history. And there's no way that you can push it to one side. If you accept that the Aborigines had property, had sovereignty, and they lost it, this can't be anything else but one of the most important parts of our history, and I think it has to be recognised. And if we are, as I say, as I said before, if war is to be all important, then we have to come to terms with this war, we have to recognise it, we have to pay respect to those involved in it, and we have to find ways to commemorate it.
There would be some Henry Reynolds that would argue that these sorts of thoughts constitute a black armband view of Australian history.
Well, they probably would, but I mean, Geoffrey Blainey coined the term. He wasn't specifically talking about the Aboriginal question. He was also talking about race and gender. And because he chose the black armband, i.e. the symbol of mourning, it was taken up and seen to be relating just to racial questions. But I don't think it's a particularly useful term. You know, the alternative term, the white blindfold, is another slogan, but I think they're slogans that, you know, are now dated and are no longer useful.
Well, I wonder if with a new maturity of this new century, Henry Reynolds, we may at last be ready for that recognition and that conversation. Thanks for joining us this morning.
A great pleasure.
Historian Henry Reynolds. Up next, and for a rather different take, hear my interview with the director of the Australian War Memorial, Brendan Nelson.
Later today on This American Life, Blairsville, Georgia is like a lot of small towns. Everybody knows everybody else. There's always tons of gossip. But something changed when everybody started posting gossip online. People believed it.
And so I lost my job. And then people I knew would just walk on past me. I would say hi. They wouldn't even acknowledge the fact that I was even standing there.
Tonight, 7 o'clock. You're on ABC Radio National.
This year marks 100 years since the start of World War I. And next year, of course, 100 years since the Gallipoli landings of 1915. It's a big year for the Australian War Memorial and for its director, Brendan Nelson. We spoke in February and I began by asking him about the importance of this anniversary for the memorial.
Well, every year of the centenary of the First War will be big for reasons that we all understand. 2015, Anzac Landing, of course, will be the most significant event. But part of our challenge, of course, Jonathan, is to see that Australians understand that there was much, much more to the First World War than the Gallipoli landing.
Well, talk us through that, because, I mean, this is integral to your institution, the Australian War Memorial, founded on Remembrance Day in 1941. It's about the First World War.
Yeah, the origins of the memorial are, of course, the First World War, and Australia's First World War official historian was Charles Bean, and he had landed with the troops at Gallipoli on the 25th of April 1915 and remained with them at the front until the war's end. And it was in 1916 at Pozieres, where Australia had 23,000 casualties in 6 weeks, that Bean wrote in his diary, "Many a man lying out there at Pozieres and in the low scrub at Gallipoli with his poor, tired senses barely working through the fever of his brain has thought in his last moments, well, it's over, but in Australia they will be proud of this." Shortly after that, a dying Australian soldier turned to Bean and said, "Will they remember this?" Bean had been thinking about doing something at the war's end and then resolved that he would build the finest memorial and museum to the men of the AIF and the nurses, and hence that's what we now have. It wasn't, of course, until, as you point out, until the Second World War, Australia having understandably been very anti-war, going through the Great Depression, it wasn't until 1941 it was finally opened, and then, of course, the Second World War's in train.
It's a real sine curve in our remembrance of the First World War. It goes through many permutations, as you say, that period through the Depression, I guess other things on the national mind, but in turn as well have seen, from that anti-war sense that through the 60s and 70s in this country as well, this sort of rebirth of remembrance and commemoration.
I think we've matured in our understanding of this. I'm 55. I was born in 1958 and a member perhaps of the last generation that was given a pre-packaged set of values of God, King and Country. Those kind of things, for a variety of reasons, have broken down somewhat, and young people are increasingly looking for and finding a sense of meaning in what it means to be an Australian, not in the wars that we've engaged in over the last century or so, but in the qualities and the values that they find and they perceive to be in the men and women who wear, and in particular who have worn, these uniforms. And they differentiate that from the madness, as they see it, of some of the wars and certainly some of the battles.
In a sense, it becomes simpler to make those distinctions the further we move from the event, perhaps, although that distance, well, it can work the other way too, can't it? Henry Reynolds has this view of the carnival of commemoration, I mean, the way in which the marking of something like the First World War can be more of a celebration than a commemoration. That's perhaps because of the distance from the event.
And I think we have to be very careful about this. I keep, every day actually, Jonathan, I'm correcting people. People with good heart and will say to me, oh look, Brendan, the Anzac celebrations, you know, we're doing this, or I've got an idea. And I have to say, look, please, it is a commemoration. Australia was 4.5 million, about the population of Melbourne today. 1 million men were of an age that could volunteer. From a nation that twice rejected conscription, a deeply divided nation at home, we had 420,000 men who did volunteer. We sent 330,000 overseas, 62,000 dead, another 60,000 dead within 10 years of getting back from 155,000 wounded. It left very, very deep wounds in this nation and scars that inform, in many ways, a sense of who we are today. But the paradox of it all, Jonathan, is that we became a nation, we federated in 1901. We were already Australia, the Commonwealth. Yes. But for a lot of Australians, whether you're a Queenslander, a Victorian, a Western Australian, when we send Australians off overseas in an Australian uniform with an Australian flag, you turned to the national government with questions for decisions, for leadership. And with the passage of time following the First World War, we look back on it, and in many ways it galvanised our sense of who we are, how we relate to one another and see our place in the world.
It's an interesting argument, though, isn't it? Because, as you say, we'd federated in 1901. There was much that this country was doing before and around and after the First World War, an extraordinarily traumatic event for the country, and yet it's that, rather than many of these other things, many of these other achievements, that we choose to determine as sort of this birthplace of national sense.
Yeah, well, it's interesting. I was a member of the Parliament, the Federal Parliament, in 2001, and we marked the centenary of Federation, and it was something that was deeply appreciated, if not titillated, the intellectual chattering classes and the leadership of the country, including us who were, you know, in the political leadership. But for the average Australian, it was kind of, oh, okay, 100 years since we federated.
Henry who? What,
yeah, well, yeah, exactly. I know. But what we are about to commemorate for the everyday Australian is a series of far more significant events. And by the way, one of the things that's very reassuring, because it resonated with my own sense of this, we did some focus group research early last year, this is the War Memorial, to find out from a range of people of different age groups, demographics, non-English speaking Australians, as well as those of us who were born here. And it was interesting. What we found was that people said, I want to know why the war happened. Why was Australia in it? Please don't give me myth and legend. What happened as beyond Gallipoli landing? What else happened in the war? Yeah. Also, how did Australia change? And what happened after the war? We have this tendency, human beings that we are, to settle for the broad brushstrokes, the overarching figures, you know, the 62,000 dead, for example. What we've got to do is look beyond that to the individual sacrifices that have been made in our name, and the good, and as Charles Bean described, the bad, the greatness and the smallness.
That's tremendously reassuring research that you've done there, Brendan Nelson, on many respects, that there is that curiosity about the fuller truth of an event like the First World War. I mean, because I think people have an anxiety that something like Gallipoli is plucked out of context and is made to mean many things, and sometimes made to mean things that suit our contemporary sense of self rather than what actually happened back then in 1915.
You're absolutely right, and we recognise 2,000 Australians were sent back from Egypt before they went off to Gallipoli for all kinds of things, burning down brothels, drunkenness, venereal diseases and other things. We recognise that. But we also recognise and have deep admiration for the sacrifices that were made. And the other aspect to this story, of course, is the Indigenous story. Here were Indigenous men in a country where the first fleet had arrived in 1788 with all of the dreadful, devastating consequences for Indigenous Australia that that meant. And then 130, 140 years later, they are working desperately to sign up and enlist. They came from a very unequal society into the hands of Australia's first equal opportunity employer, the Australian Army, where everyone was treated equally well and equally badly.
You all have a perfect right to die for your country.
Yes. And then they used all sorts of means to get past the ethos at the time, which was that this was a European war and so on and so forth. And that's another part of the story, which, of course, we're drawing out in everything that we do.
And the memorial's to be commended for that recognition. I mean, there's another argument. Of course, we mentioned Henry Reynolds before. He makes the case for marking those colonial wars. Now, perhaps not from the point of view of European fighters in those, but as much as we mark the contribution of Indigenous Australians to the Australian military forces in World War I, World War II and wars that followed, might we not also mark their contribution as warriors fighting for their own homeland?
Well, look, this is a very important issue, and I think Henry Reynolds and others who are arguing that the story of armed conflict between Indigenous Australians and the European settlers through the late 18th and then the 19th centuries, I think they are right. I do think, however, it is wrong to characterise that relationship as being a war. We were not North America. We weren't even New Zealand. It was a very rich and complex relationship, at one end with illustrations of extreme beneficence on both sides, through to the most appalling things that happened with massacres. So from the Australian War Memorial's perspective, our charter, our origins, is not about conflict within Australia. It is about Australians, non-Indigenous and Indigenous Australians, deployed in the defence of this nation, its values and its interests. That story about the Indigenous relationship, in my very strong view, and that of the Council of our memorial, by the way, is it should be told at the National Museum of Australia. The other very practical thing, Jonathan, is that the basis of the Australian War Memorial is our collection. Charles Bean started collecting things in 1916, uniforms, equipment, diaries, letters, all of those sort of things. Even if the Australian War Memorial were to tell the story of these armed conflicts, we don't actually have any collection to actually tell it. Where it does reside, it's held in some of our state museums. The National Museum of Australia has some, yes, and some of the British museums have it. So I do respect the people who are arguing that the story should be told. In fact, I entirely agree with them. I do, however, part company with the idea that there was some sort of war that was declared on Indigenous Australians. But that's, you know, it's a free country. We can have those debates.
Brendan Nelson is director of the Australian War Memorial. This is Sunday Extra. We're chatting over what begins this year, in the middle of this year, the commemoration of the Great War of 1914-1918, and of Gallipoli, which followed that. If I can, a slightly personal reflection here, Brendan, and you mentioned Bean's experience of from Gallipoli, then reflecting again in Pozieres, that was exactly the journey of my grandfather, whose right arm is still somewhere in the dirt at Pozieres. He luckily returned almost in one piece. Now, I mentioned this because I went to France and I did the obligatory Australian thing of wanting to see this battleground and the others in that part of France. And my guide on that tour, this was at the time when Australia was very actively excavating at Fromelles and making great fuss over the small relics that we were finding there and marking those graves for the first time. And he was agog at this, as he took us, our little tour group, from one mass grave to another mass grave to another mass grave, and with this sense that this part of France was full of unmarked death and commemoration, not just from this war, but for generations of wars before. I wonder if sometimes Australia, because of the severity of the impact of this conflict on our small population, has a very different sense of this to the Europeans, and perhaps it skews our thought of the First World War in maybe an unhelpful way?
Look, I think we do have a different perspective. I part company with you on the idea that it's unhelpful. For three of the 50 countries involved in the First World War, it wasn't just a cataclysmic disaster. It was, for Australia, New Zealand and Canada, a war which ultimately gave birth to a sense of unity and purpose and place in the world, paradoxically. But also, I lived in Europe for the first time for 3 years. I lived in Brussels as our ambassador to NATO and the European Union and Belgium. And it wasn't until I lived in Europe that I realised how much war and invasion of your own country and the constant rewriting of borders informs every aspect of European thinking and identity.
It's utterly part of life there, isn't it?
It is. And look, and I found Belgians, for example, who would get much more exercised about the Battle of Waterloo or events that happened with the Spanish in the Middle Ages than they would even about the First World War. That the Second World War underwrote almost every part of discourse, political, economic and social. We as Australians were interesting in the sense that the Indigenous people, of course, will disagree quite reasonably with this view, but we haven't been invaded. We've had wars. Our vital interests were desperately at stake in the Second World War in 1942 and 43 in particular. But we commemorate our involvement in these wars. We commemorate the sacrifice. But we move on. Whereas in Europe, it's different. I mean, people often forget, you know, when they're criticising the European Union, amongst other things, they forget we've had the longest period of peace on continental Europe in its history since 1945. And the other thing for us as Australians, and this is important, I spent a lot of time in cemeteries, battlefields, the Menin Gate in Ypres, and I spent a lot of time reading epitaphs. One of them is of that private Ian Hart, who was 30 years old when he was killed on the 26th of November 1916. His mother wrote the epitaph for his headstone. It's at the Guards Cemetery in Arras, just off the Somme. She wrote, "I gave my son, he gave his all, his life, for Australia and Empire." Now, the reason I say that is we have to look beyond, as I say, the broad brushstrokes to these individual sacrifices. Every one of those men, some of them boys, that we found at Pheasant Wood, or that will be found again, there were five that were found at Zonnebeck in 2006, every one of them is a person who was loved. And in fact, at the burial of the five who were found at Zonnebeck when they were buried at the Polygon Wood Cemetery, an 84-year-old cousin said that his parents kept his photograph on their mantelpiece and his bedroom unchanged until they died. That is why we go to all this effort.
And yet there's something in that European experience, there's something about our fixing on something that was as unfortunate and unmitigated a disaster as Gallipoli. It says something about the slenderness of our history that would have that significance.
Yeah, I think that's a good point. The Indigenous people here, of course, have a very long and rich and deep history. For Australia, since the First Fleet and certainly since our Federation, it is relatively short. But nonetheless, as T.S. Eliot wrote, a people without history is not redeemed from time, because history is a pattern of endless moments. And a people, in my view, that neither knows nor worse still understands its history is frankly dangerous. We need to know it, and we need to understand it. We need to understand it in its truth, both the good, as been said, and the bad, but we also need to know how it informs who we are today, and importantly, who we want to become.
A lot of that discussion, a lot of that sense in these coming years, Brendan Nelson, thank you so much for your time and insights this morning.
Thank you, Jonathan. I appreciate it very much.
You're listening to Sunday Extra here on RN. Jonathan Green with you this Easter Sunday.